duck, duck, goose! Duck of Minerva in stereo.
Hi, this is Dan Nexon.
And this is Patrick Jackson.
And we're going to call this the Brain Melt episode.
Yes, since we've now reached that time of year for academics when everything starts kind of turning into a big mushy blob of, oh my goodness, the students are coming back on campus and I haven't finished the 10,000 things I wanted to do this summer moment.
August is the cruelest month if you're in university admin.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, it is. Endless meetings and endless moments where the plans that you had laid over the course of the summer, you know, the old shtick about how the battle plan never survives contact with the enemy. Well, the administration plans never survive contact when the faculty show back up. And then you go, oh, okay, so people have different ideas about this. Gee, let's rethink everything that we've been thinking about for the last couple of months. So, you know, there's a lot of that going on.
It sounds to me like you've gone over or gone native, as they say. The faculty is now the enemy, Patrick.
Well, no, I'm just making a funny. No, I think that we had designed a set of structures and things for the next year, which then, of course, because we were sort of we're doing a draft of them ourselves, now we're showing them to a much wider constituency, and so now there's a lot more discussion that has to be had about these things. And unfortunately, it happens at the same time as people are coming back and having to do the logistical stuff and the mechanics of actually getting their syllabi together. And so then you're following up to make sure that everybody's books are ordered and all that kind of stuff. So it's this combination of the profound and the mundane all run together.
Well, at least so we have a little bit more than a week before classes start. And I'm in charge of TA assignments.
Mm.
Which are kind of a hypothetical thing right now because we've had all sorts of fun budget glitches and other things that just have to do with everybody's moving to a new system and the people who are doing this on our end are kind of green. They're wonderful people. But so I may be spending my tomorrow morning at least playing triage, getting teaching assistants to the intro courses announced so that, you know, faculty can start planning with their helpers.
Sounds familiar. Sounds very familiar. We were doing that yesterday.
Well, then I don't. When do you start?
We start on Monday. So,
like this Monday, Monday.
Yeah, like 3 days from now, 4 days from now.
Oh well, then I'm like Mr. Ahead of Time.
Yeah, completely. No, we suddenly discovered a few days ago that the course rosters that we thought we had for the creation of some special mentorship sections turned out to be inaccurate because they included students who shouldn't be on them in the first place, and so we spent a lot of time going through and cleaning up the rosters and who goes where and how many more student mentors do we need, you know, all of this stuff that you just don't really want to have to spend half your day doing because you have other things you have to do, but then these immediate fires come up and have to be put out.
It's kind of like being a regional desk officer at the Department of Defense, except for none of it matters.
We're here at the Department of Defense.
No comment. So I think that we've convinced our audience that university administration type tasks are unbelievably tedious and not all that fun to listen to.
Let me just say one other thing though, because the great thing about university administration is that when you manage to not have to spend time down in the weeds doing all these little nitty-gritty nuts and bolts things, it's one of the few occasions you have as an academic to really think broadly about curricular issues and what should be done in terms of education more broadly. I haven't been a regular full-time faculty member since boy, like 2007, because I was half-time admin. As just a regular faculty member, you're concerned with your own courses and your own research, and you don't have much incentive or occasion to really sit down and think more broadly about the whole point of the exercise. And the thing about university admin is at its best, you do get a chance to do things like sit down and write 3 or 4 page vision documents of what undergraduate education should look like. You know, kind of think about the big questions of what should students be learning? How do we most effectively deliver it to them?
Okay, but let's be clear about this. So you have the big thoughts, you write the brilliant memo, uh-huh. then you form the curricular reform committee.
Yep.
Then you go through 6 months of mind-numbing tedium. At the end, you issue a report suggesting that you form some more committees to think about some of the issues raised in the curriculum reform committee. And then you rinse and repeat, right?
Sometimes, but sometimes on the way, you actually make recommendations that get implemented and you change stuff. I mean, in the course of the next 6 months, we're proposing to radically revision the whole undergraduate curriculum at the school as a result of this task force that went up last year and made some proposals. And so what I'm doing now is talking to large numbers of people about some of the proposed pretty significant changes in the way we do concentrations and seminars and so on and so forth. So if we do this right, then it won't actually just be let's have another committee, but it will be let's take the program that we have and make it that much more awesome.
Okay, I'm in favor of awesomeness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's interesting though because this is like serious inside baseball here, right? But I mean, part of the issue
is why you really want to put it on a podcast, Patrick.
Totally.
Okay.
But no. I mean, the thing that's odd, right? The position I have now is a position that didn't exist before. It used to be just sort of one associate dean for the whole School of International Service for both the graduate and the undergraduate programs, and now we've got these two separate associate deans. So the undergraduate program is sort of being administered as a separate entity than the graduate program, which makes a lot of intellectual sense, but just wasn't the way we did our bureaucratic process. So now changing that means you can think about things like what exactly should undergrads be learning, and is it the same thing as what graduate students should be learning, to which I think the answer is no. But now we actually get a chance to do that, which is pretty cool. And so they're having this big discussion among all sorts of people about what actually should we be doing at that point. That's the fun part. The tedium part is, okay, let's start thinking about these piddly resource issues about who's going to teach what class at what point in time and those sorts of things.
Okay, well, I'm going to force a chapter break here.
Please do.
And I thought one thing that we might talk about for a few seconds at least, or maybe a few minutes, is political rhetoric on foreign policy in this campaign, because I thought you'd have some interesting things to say about that. My general sense is that we're not getting a substantive debate about foreign policy. There are a couple of issues with substantive implications, U.S. policy towards Russia, how hardline to be against China. But a lot of what we're getting are kind of, particularly, if I have to say this, on the Republican side, are really articulations of values, right, and cultural commitments in the context of foreign policy matters. Is that your sense?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's quite accurate. I mean, as usual with U.S. political debates, we're getting, in effect, the use of the international as a domestic bargaining chip, rather than a sustained analysis of global politics of any kind.
Have you had a chance to follow any of the kind of major arguments that are being made about what's wrong with Obama foreign policy from the usual suspects, whether it's on Russia or China or let's hug and apologize?
I'll be honest, I have not. I tend to get I get kind of disgusted by the analysis or quote unquote analysis, and I haven't had the patience to kind of wade through some of that stuff, at least the stuff that's been happening relatively recently.
You have a superficial sense of what it's like because
it's not
terribly new.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you've done all this work on American foreign policy rhetoric and the legitimation of grand strategy and identity.
Right.
How would you characterize this kind of talk, right? Claims about, you know, America should not be apologizing. Obama went on a quote-unquote apology tour, particularly claims about selling U.S. interests short in the face of the Russians or not really being credible to our allies for reasons I don't fully understand, but they seem to have something to do, again, with general notions of American weakness, fixation on the defense budget and the size of the defense budget. How does that fit into the history of American political debate about foreign policy?
Yeah, that's it's it's funny, especially as you start talking about sort of the fixation on the size of the defense budget. I mean, I flash back to this lovely book that I have on my bookshelf that I picked up when I was starting to first do work on the Cold War rhetorics and discussions of American identity in the early 50s. It's this book called Home Canning for Victory, which discusses the way that Americans have to become much more self-sufficient in their food sources so that they can have adequate nutrition to beat the nasty communists and so on and so forth. The book had the latter half of the book turns into a rant about fluoridation in the water and how it's sapping American manhood and so on and so forth. Why do I bring that up? Because it's the same damn piece of rhetoric, right? We are being racked by internal weakness that we ourselves, through our own turning back to the light, can somehow strengthen ourselves, and then we don't have to apologize to anyone for anything that we have done. We will be able to stand strong and stand proud, and et cetera, et cetera. And somehow it's a character weakness of ours, right? That we have some sort of deep flaw that has caused us to, I mean, to be blunt, turn away from God's path for the power of America. And even when I say that, it starts to sound like a freaking presidential speech, right? I mean, this is some of that basic template of U.S. foreign policy speeches. I remember when we did that piece on the Borg in American foreign policy, and we went back and did that analysis of all of the State of the Union speeches. And it's the same line. It's the same set of rhetorics every time about the chosenness and specialness of America. And all we have to do is stay true to our own values. And as long as we do that, everything will come out okay in the end. And those values are always about freedom and individuality and equality and democracy. And it's the same litany, right? I mean, you could create a nice little bot on the internet that would just basically generate these things. And you'd have a pretty good prediction of what every speech will look like. It's eerily similar. And the whole size of the defense budget thing, I mean, this is back to, this is exactly the same discussion as you find sort of throughout the Cold War, right? It's not enough. We've got a missile gap. We've got not enough commitment to particular things. We're not big enough. We're not powerful enough. It's just the endless repetition of the same riff.
Well, then one thing that you would probably like about this campaign season is the way in which American exceptionalism has been placed firmly on the front burner. I mean, a major criticism of the Obama administration and Barack Obama, whatever its basis in reality, is that one of his flaws that's supposed to then lead to all these bad things in foreign policy is that does not believe in the exceptionalness of the United States. So this would be great because it's, explicit, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was a piece that I wrote a while back, which is in a review process someplace, about the difference in Obama's style when it comes to thinking about foreign policy. That Obama's version of this stuff is less about the American messianic, proclaiming the truth to the world that it itself only knows, and much more. I think of the piece, I think I actually called it a witnessing style. Here is what we've done, and here's what's great about the way we've done it. Full stop. Now there's other ways in which people can do things, and let's sort of talk more generally about what that would look like. That's always a hard sell in the U.S.
But is that the only, I mean, is that the, if we're going to sort of remain within a broad exceptionalist frame, which I think to be whatever the accusations made by hardline conservatives, the fact of the matter is that it's so deeply embedded in American political discourse that you're only going to get varieties of exceptionalism, at least at the level where it's politically consequential. Is that right? Am I wrong empirically about that, by the way?
Well, it depends on how narrowly you want to define exceptionalism, right? Because one of the successful strategies...
All right, so now we're going to talk about Theodore Roosevelt, who is in... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, one of the successful strategies is to keep the exceptionalism but change the reference community. So it becomes the exceptionalism of the civilized, or the exceptionalism of the West, or the exceptionalism of the Anglo-Saxons or whatever. That there's a broader group that the U.S. is part of, but that broader group is itself exceptional in world history. So you can kind of transfer the exceptionalism. American exceptionalism, narrowly defined as just the United States, is is exempt from the rest of the rules that apply to humanity, but it is exempt from those rules not simply because it's different, but because it's somehow superior. Right, and I think that's an important nuance. I mean, you know, when Japan claims that it's immune from certain kinds of trade regulations because of the peculiarities of the Japanese diet or whatever, that's not really exceptionalism. That's just an exemption. Whereas the U.S. is saying we're exceptional; the rules don't apply to us because we are, you know, the voice of God speaking to humanity. We are something higher and better that's going to come in and reform everything. That gesture, that kind of full exceptionalist gesture. And this is back to the Anders Stephenson arguments in Manifest Destiny, right? That is sort of like part of the cultural DNA of the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine a successful presidential candidate that didn't at least nod in that direction.
Yeah, and then you get into accusations about whether you really believe it or not. I think one of the things that I find kind of depressing about all this has to do with trends in relative power. So I am not, as you know, when we've talked about this before, I'm not in the what is conventionally understood as the declinist camp, right? I do not believe that the U.S. is in some sort of free fall and we're going to be overtaken by everybody else and the world is going to be radically different in terms of the reach of American power in 5 or 10 years. I do believe that we're going through a relative power transition to Asia, and even if China kind of stalls or filters out, that broader power transition to the Asia-Pacific is pretty much a done deal. And that means that the U.S. is going to have less freedom of action than it enjoyed in the late 90s. It also means that the U.S. is going to have to accommodate to the possibility of countries being able to deny it access if they make a concerted effort to various parts of the world. Yeah, all that kind of stuff, right? So we're in a world where the U.S. doesn't enjoy the kind of exceptional power, or will not enjoy in the future the kind of exceptional power it enjoyed for about a 10-15-year window, right? So fair enough, right? We got that?
Yeah.
So the question is, how can America accommodate to an environment in which it's not constantly rising, right? Because so much of American exceptionalist rhetoric is premised around a kind of historical teleology that requires the U.S. to always be on the rise, or if it's not on the rise, for it to have been waylaid and need to do certain things to get back on the rise, right? So it's a story either about an inevitable rise, which can be forestalled or screwed up by having the wrong values, the wrong politics, or what have you. I mean, whatever. So it strikes me that that's not a good set of resources to handle a situation in which you're not the rising power, in which you have to accommodate to a more multipolar, distributed world.
Right. No, I completely agree that there is an increasing mismatch between the narrative and the kind of situation that we're actually going to be confronting and attempting to grapple with by using that narrative. If it were only the case that narratives followed structural positions, then this wouldn't be a problem because the narrative would just kind of adjust, except that we both know and have argued on many occasions that that's just not true, right? The narrative outlives the situation in which it might have been well adapted for and can often be very dysfunctional when people just kind of keep adhering to it. I think that probably the two most likely, I mean, speculative here, but the two most likely sort of avenues that I could see, one of them would actually be something more like, and this is interesting because sometimes Obama does this, or sometimes his people do this, drawing on the resources of what is usually misnamed American isolationism, and saying there are ways in which the U.S. should disengage from different parts of the world for the sake of preserving itself. We mistake isolationism as being we don't want anything to do with the rest of the world, as if that was just sort of the only thing about it. But a lot of that language and a lot of that writing is about keeping sort of a clear sight of the mission of America, or what America's values are. So we could say, all right, so we need to disengage and roll back from certain kinds of things because they just don't concern us. So I could see a reinvigoration of that. What's weird about that, of course, is that as soon as you start saying that, you open yourself up to accusations of weakness, which I think is part of what's going on right now. So that becomes the hard thing to try to deal with is that idea of disengagement as being some sort of a reinvigorated isolationism.
Well, I see the gestalt of, you know, what we would retroactively call the Obama grand strategy or whatever, right? And, you know, and sort of in the, not in the view that there is a template for grand strategy, but we can kind of retroactively go back and describe in a reconstructive sort of way what that strategy entailed, right? Mm-hmm. I sort of see the gestalt of that as being something more along the lines of the transference strategy that you were talking about, that America is special. America has exemplary characteristics, and it has exceptional characteristics, but that those exceptional characteristics are part of a broader community, and right. a broader community which is not a closed community, right, which other groups can join. So we move right. from Western civilization to the community of democracy, or the community of kind of commitment to what we sometimes call a liberal international order. Mm-hmm. That strikes me as the dominant strategy, not one withdrawal, because the U.S. is not pulling out of areas. It's changing the way that engages to that it engages to try to maximize scarce fiscal resources, but right. certainly not drawing down in any meaningful way.
No, and in fact, what I was kind of leading up to was that the neo-isolationist withdrawal strategy is, I think, one of two possibilities. The other one is this liberal order strategy, in which you still have the same kind of commitments, but you change the commitments to something else, something sort of institutional rather than cultural. I have to admit, I'm skeptical of that one. I actually don't know how far the attachment to "quote unquote," the liberal order will carry politically, because you know at the end of the day, I don't actually think that most political legitimation is about principles of rationality. It's about cultural values, and I think that that a lot of this stuff is not going to. It's like the commitment to the liberal order is a very thin overlay on top of or in conjunction with a set of cultural arguments, right? I mean, this is back to that Katzenstein and Hemmer piece in I.O. a number of years ago. It was badly titled, I thought. Why is there no NATO in Asia? But they're on to something, right? I mean, part of the reason there's no multilateral security arrangement that the U.S. is involved with in that part of the world because there's no cultural narrative that puts the U.S. in that part of the world as a player. As a player on the same cultural field as the rest of the countries in that order, the way there is in the transatlantic world, right? So I think that the absence of that makes that liberal order and the commitment to that liberal order incredibly thin and incredibly precarious and very sensitive to downturns. I mean, I go back to my favorite book by Habermas. Yes, I have a favorite book by Habermas, even though I'm largely critical of a lot of Habermas's stuff. I have a favorite book by Habermas, right? I go back to Legitimation Crisis. If you don't have, this is Habermas writing in like, you know, what's it, the English translation, 75. I forget when he actually wrote the thing. But Legitimation Crisis, he points out, if you don't actually have sets of broader cultural and ethical commitments that hold a social order together and you make it purely performance-based, then you're very sensitive to fluctuations in performance, and then people's approval goes up and down with fluctuations in performance. Banking everything on a thin notion of the international liberal order, I think, makes it incredibly fragile. Well, because then we you know, something happens and there's a little bit of an economic downturn, and then all of a sudden it goes away.
Okay, well, but I don't want to pursue this particular line of thought, but I will say that there's liberal order in the sense that somebody like John Eikenberry means it, right? Where we're talking about a whole set of institutions. And, you know, the IMF, the UN, the WTO, et cetera, right? And you have this kind of notion of a rule-based order, a kind of, you call it thin, but in a sense it's substantively thick, right? And I have in mind something a little different, which is more of a kind of, maybe something more along the lines of something that might be amenable to critical geographers, right? An idea of space that is somehow intermeshed with Americanness. Right. And I think that it's possible. I think what we've seen actually is the construction of a set of spaces that are intermeshed with Americanness in various degrees, with various intensities, that are coterminous with some of the players of the liberal order. Right. And there are historical commitments for that. There are sort of all sorts of interest group politics involved in that. But the way that cashes out is a sort of sense of a set of spaces in which the United States has some sets of obligations or reciprocal obligations and identity obligations and cultural obligations, too. And a really good example of a strong version of this is the U.S. relationship with Israel. right? But let's not go there because I don't want to go there.
I have a puzzled expression on my face right now because I actually don't think the U.S. commitment to Israel has much to do with that. I think it's religious.
Oh well, look. So I'm talking about a formal set of relationships, right? That we could define as kind of a libero-American sphere, right? Right. Does that make any sense?
I'm sort of following.
So the particular reasons why those cultural commitments exist are independent of what I mean by this kind of liberal order, right?
Oh, okay. Yep. All right. I got it. All right. Now that makes sense, right? You were making a bit of a form content distinction that I wasn't at the beginning of thinking about it. But yeah, right. Now that makes sense to me. It's instantiated differently with different kinds of cultural contexts. Mm-hmm. But what you're looking at here is simply the character of those ties.
So you're talking about the kind of available resources and the nature of those ties, right, that would make them stronger or weaker or more politically potent.
Got it.
And I'm talking about a kind of geography. Right. Identity. Of glory.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No. We're approaching the same puzzle from sort of slightly different sides.
Eventually, we'd wind up on some kind of discussion about mutations in Western civilization and Westernity, yep, and other types of neologisms. But
yes.
So one of the things that I think that's kind of interesting about what you're suggesting, and this is just a thought, is that, you know, the United States is doing okay, actually, in a lot of measures, right? This is why I find the a lot of declinism is a reaction to the Great Recession, right? We've been here before. We've seen some of this before. And the U.S., you know, there are a lot of vulnerabilities, and we could see some really bad things going on. The U.S. is not having a great time of it, but this isn't a lost decade yet, or it doesn't look like it's going to be a lost decade. It looks like it's going to be a kind of grayish or hard to find decade. But if you're right, you know, sort of, if you think about kind of constitutive order or kind of identity based geographies, right, then the big problem here, the big sense of there's a way in which at least we could tell a story. This is going to sound weird, but we could tell a story that part of the real underlying impetus of declinism is not really about us, it's about what's happening in Europe. Right. And it's the decay of the European side of that Western civilizational order.
Huh. Decay. Decay in what sense?
Well, in the sense that if...
Or so, do you mean decline?
Well, I think I would talk about it in terms of decay, right? Which is the sense that the European project right now is in decay. It could be resuscitated or what have you.
All right.
And we could talk about decline. I mean, we could talk about sort of overall economic performance, but the loss of confidence in the European mission, right? In Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly if you are an American policymaker and you're looking to Europe, you don't see a community that right now can uphold anything like a military security partnership.
Right.
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 You know, defense budgets are being slashed. You know, the only country that's doing rather well are the Germans, who in some respects are the least committed to some of the key issues on NATO cohesion. You know, certainly the kind of concerns of the Eastern Europeans and stuff like that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this isn't to any sense of maligning the Germans. It's just a kind of observation about internal politics within NATO. In that sense, you know, things are going look to be so poor because the other prop of Western civilization is looking really sickly right now.
True.
And thus you have kind of on the one hand, you don't have to worry about it so much because they're not going to fight a great power war, which is nice. So that can enable an Asia pivot. But on the other hand, the whole notion of trying to relocate the United States as a kind of Pacific power, which is where the action is and what the United States needs to be thinking about in a lot of respects in terms of long-durée great power politics, means abandoning or downgrading part of the identity project that's central to American international commitments.
Yeah. No. I would definitely agree with that. I mean, especially since so much of the centrality of Europe to that American project was wrapped up with the dynamic of we, the Americans, have been sort of we're the exiles from Europe, and then we've gone back to save it because it needed saving. And now there doesn't seem to be a heck of a lot we can do to save it, because it isn't under the sort of threat that we can come and, you know, shore up the way that we tell ourselves that we did in the late 40s and early 50s.
There's neither the political will nor the mechanism in place for a new Marshall Plan for the U.S. to get involved in bailing out Greece, which also is part of the reason, or Spain or Italy, which is part of the reason I think why we feel kind of helpless right now, is the big immediate threat to American prosperity is something we can't do anything about.
Right.
Which is sort of unique in the post-1945 era.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could always, in the past, you could always, you know, point to the Russians or point to Chinese troops or something and say, okay, here, there's something concrete that I can actually do something about. We had also tooled ourselves up to the point where we could actually, you know, we could put troops in the field. We could do things.
Or we could put dollars in the field, right? Yeah. Which is precisely what we don't feel like we have right now.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting set of thoughts that maybe we could pursue. But I go back to, you know, your first book and your set of arguments, which is that the way that we legitimate U.S. engagement in the world after the Second World War is to reconstitute Western civilization as a community that stops at the Elbe, right?
Right.
And then after the end of the Cold War and then the collapse of the Soviet Union, that community gets to be expanded outward, further east along the Elbe. Right. But going back to Katzenstein and Hemmer, and I tend to sort of take a more power political view of why there's no multilateralism in Asia. I'm kind of in the Victor Cha camp. But irrespective of that, it is certainly the case that it is much harder to make an argument for the centrality of Japan or South Korea to Western civilization than it is to make a claim about Rome or Athens or Paris or even, you know, Warsaw and Krakow, right?
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, you don't have the right kind of long-term cultural imagination that would sustain something like that. I mean, and it's not even that you have a vacuum. I mean, I remember being, and I still get asked, you know, how come your first book wasn't a comparison of post-war Germany and post-war Japan? Well, because it's not that there wasn't a tradition of the West in Japan. It's that there was, and it had virtually nothing in common with the tradition of the West in the countries that considered themselves to be part of the West. It's not like the Japanese had not envisioned the West. They had. There was an elaborate system of thinking about the West and the difference Japan had from it, right? So it's not even that there isn't a basis for imagining it. It's that there's a cultural basis that actively militates against imagining them as part of the West.
So the challenge of the Pacific century, or the challenge, I mean, whichever party wins the next election, will see increased emphasis on the Pacific. It's a geostrategic necessity, and it also, you know, in an economic necessity. And frankly, you know, the major debate is whether or not we need to spend a lot more on our Navy so that we can deal with what's happening in the Pacific or not, not whether we need to be there in doing what I called in a recent post kind of developing containment capacity as a hedge against things going horribly wrong with the Chinese. But there aren't a lot of resources around for constructing this Pacific orientation in American identity that aren't tied up, as I understand it, with Manifest Destiny and imperial legacies. So
right.
it's going to be pretty challenging. It's going to be interesting.
It is. It definitely is. And because exactly the numbers of resources that we do have are precisely those resources that involve the manifest absurdity of going in to try to civilize China.
Well, then we're back to missionaries, right?
Exactly.
So maybe it's all religion.
Exactly. Exactly. But like that those are the traditions that we have. So, you know.
All right. Well, I think this is a good place for us to maybe stop, given our mental states, which are close to non-existent.
But hey, for a non-existent mental state, we covered quite a lot of really interesting ground there, and it's interesting because one thing, and I mean, this is to end.
We think we're so interesting. That's why we keep on saying it's interesting as a preface to whatever we say.
Totally. But no, and just to end this on a slightly more, I guess, slightly more personal note, I appreciate the fact that you often push me back to think about some of the implications of my first book that I tend not to think about, because for me, the whole operation of drawing present and future consequences from the study of these things that happened in the past is not something that sort of comes naturally to me. And as we talk about it, there clearly are implications. And I appreciate that you kind of push toward those, because that's sort of not where my thinking goes initially. Well, so I'm glad you keep pushing me to do that.
Well, that's maybe what we can use some of these podcasts for. So before we sign off, I think that it's probably we've only done it once, but I suspect that it's going to be a tradition that we fade out on some horrible Patrick Prague. So please send me a clip of something suitably unappealing to my musical tastes so that I can have our moment of blank.
All right. I will do so.
And I will mention that there, you know, that our pseudonymous commentator, Guy Fox, has requested that the music on our afternoon videos become more diverse. And the dirty secret here is that once I exhaust my indie pop and some of my 80s and 90s alternative and some techno, I'm pretty much out of stuff. So I think that you and some of the other members of the doc are going to have to start contributing to that endeavor.
Okay, I think we can step up, and I have an idea for what I'd like to send you, so I'll send you something.
All right, so long.
All right, bye.
Bye. And thus we mercifully come to the conclusion of Duck of Minerva podcast number 6, recorded on August 23rd, 2012. Here it is, your moment of yes.